This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, and this is the latest episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative at Harvard University. Now, before we dive into today's episode, I want to let you know that we have a new workshop coming up on March 18th and 19th in Cambridge. It's called AI and Leadership, Integrating Gen AI into Crisis Leadership. And we're going to do a hands-on exploration in a lab-like setting, looking at how you can integrate some of the new developments in AI into your work. So if you want to check that out, you can go to our website at npli.hsph.harvard.edu. Click on the Our Programs page and you'll find it right there. Again, it's March 18th and 19th. AI and Leadership, don't miss it. And now, let's talk about today's episode, which is about narrative and recovery. Every community that faces disaster or crisis suffers trauma beyond any physical damage. And we're going to see that in New Orleans after the attack on New Year's Eve. So the fires in Los Angeles right now as we record are causing massive damage. But what comes afterwards is going to be trauma from which communities have to recover. And a crucial part of recovery is growing through that trauma into a new and hopefully better future. And that's no easy task. But one powerful approach to this journey uses narrative. The humans, we're hardwired to communicate through story ever since we sat around the campfire back in the day. Stories are how we orient ourselves with each other and to the world around us. Stories are how we learn. They're how we connect and build trust. Stories are essential to recovery. Now, we've seen an increase in severe weather and violent attacks, as well as the stress of day-to-day challenges, such as health inequities and housing insecurity and other stressors. And that resulting mental health crisis is devastating. But my guest today offers hope in the face of daunting disruption. Madison Murphy Brownie is a convener, facilitator, and consultant who uses story to tap into collective wisdom and reveal community strength and resilience. She's also, full disclosure, a former student, teaching fellow, a research assistant from her days at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. It was great to work with her then. It's great to have her here today. And her life and work have taken her around the world, and we'll hear a little bit about that. So in this episode, we're going to explore the power of narrative for healing and what Madison calls, quote, the human tapestry of wisdom rooted in collective care. I love that quote. Madison, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thank you, Eric. It's lovely to be here.
So let's start with your origin story. Tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to this work.
Yeah. So first and foremost, I am Indigenous. And so stories are a part of how I learn the world, see the world, and beyond that. And then when I was deciding to go to grad school, I was sort of looking at my past work experience and trying to find a through line there. And what I found was that my through line in my career was storytelling and public health. And so during my time as a student at the Harvard School of Public Health, I focused specifically on storytelling as a tool for health and health equity. And I remember when I was first talking this through with my advisor, he's a wonderful person. And he said, that sounds great. There aren't many jobs out there, but you could probably make one. And so, you know, the truth is that over and over, I have seen health decision makers and organizations choose on behalf of the communities that they're responsible for serving. And then as a community member, I hear so clearly that people and collectives and communities know what they need from decision makers. And so I decided to devote myself and my career of bringing those things together and creating that bridge between the people who are considered the experts through training and power, and also the true experts, the community members who, when we listen to their stories, tell us exactly, you know, where there are gaps in their care and what they need and how to formulate just responses to their needs and recovery.
That's so interesting, because again, I think in the aftermath of crises and disasters, there's always a lot of attention paid to rebuilding the physical infrastructure. There's a lot of attention paid to the processes and protocols for getting money flowing and goods, and not nearly as much, as you say, of connecting with the community, with the survivors. hearing their story and hearing what they need. So thank you for taking that sage advice from, I assume, one of my colleagues who told you there'd be a job out there you could make.
Yeah.
So I think all of our listeners should remember those words and tap into what you really want, what you're really called to do, and realize you can make a job even if one isn't in the standard job description library when you go trying to figure out what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think you touch on a really good point of, in the aftermath of a crisis or of a huge health decision, there is that need to rebuild that tapestry of trust and community resilience. And then also when we embed storytelling into our health systems and other systems ahead of crisis, we build up that community resilience so that people are connected and care for each other in that time. So it's one of those things that's really important before a crisis and in the aftermath of a crisis, and like sort of the responses feed each other when storytelling is a part of it.
Yeah, and I would remind our listeners that it's good to be capturing some of these stories as you go along, so you don't they don't get forgotten. I was just happened to be reading yesterday, following the fires out in LA, and there was a story about a very loose sort of ad hoc network of restaurants across LA that are offering food and water and shelter to people who've been displaced by the fires. That was not planned. That's what I would call a predictable surge. Communities come together. And that's the kind of story I think you can, in telling afterwards, will show how resilient the community is and show how people are ready and willing to help each other, our natural human altruism. And that needs to be captured along with the stories that will never be told about the fire and where it went and how many houses were burned, et cetera.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So what is it about stories that are so powerful? Why do they touch us so deeply as humans?
So, the good news is that we don't have a choice as to whether or not we care about stories. We are hardwired. As you mentioned, our ancestors were telling stories since time immemorial. Like stories are, they're wired into our brain and our DNA. And while we don't often get goosebumps from good data, we do get goosebumps from stories, and they connect us to each other. And as we know, the quality of our lives depends on connection, especially in times of crisis and stress. And so I am a really a true believer that policy change sits downstream of narrative change, and storytelling is a huge part of what makes narrative change possible. And as I sort of touched on before, every person and community really is the expert in what they need to be healthy and to thrive. And it's our job to offer opportunities to truly listen to their stories and learn from them. And in this way, storytelling becomes a trust-building exercise. And we owe each person that we work with and for opportunities to build that trust with the organizations that they rely on for their health and care. Because when there's that trust, there's that increase of health-seeking behaviors. And so much of the work that we need to do in the aftermath of a crisis relies on trust. And that true progress in the areas that we care the most about really happens when there is that trust, and it's built through stories and storytelling. And then sort of on a biological level, when we think about the aftermath of a crisis, having opportunities for storytelling really activates neural pathways and promotes empathy and emotional regulation. And so it really helps individuals to process traumatic experiences and integrate them into their personal narratives. And through that, it really fosters community resilience by creating the shared meaning making and collective memory. And we think about that emotional regulation piece. If you think of the life-changing decisions that people make in the aftermath of a crisis, to have a tool like storytelling that is hardwired to be a regulating tool, to have them be able to connect to others and make those decisions from a more regulated place where what has happened is sort of integrated into their personal narrative, that makes such a difference when these huge choices are being made in the aftermath of a crisis. Everyone deserves to be able to make those decisions from a place of feeling, sort of grounded, regardless of what's going around them, and as if they have the clarity they need to decide, what happens next for themselves and their loved ones and their communities as well.
Yeah, it's so important. I know I have found in the work I've done over the years in terms of looking at neuroscience and other aspects of those deep-seated human behaviors and instincts, that it's always smarter to work with them rather than trying to work against them or ignore them, because they're there for a reason. And when you can tap into them, as you're talking about, it orients us toward connection and begins to reweave that tapestry we mentioned earlier. So let's dive into a couple of concrete examples. Now, you've worked with communities in Vermont who were affected by severe flooding. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so Vermont had really severe flooding on July 10th, 2023 and 2024, which was really eerie to have them happen exactly one day apart. And the land I live on floods. My home was safe, but homes around me were lost. And in this year's flood in 2024, which I guess is now last year, I had a number of friends living in one building, and that entire building was washed away into the river. And so there's a lot of stories like that, but in the aftermath of the floods, once I was able to pass through my road, I set up these storytelling stations next to resource centers, so where they were handing out water and getting volunteer signups and things like that. And these stations offered people who'd experienced the flooding and were coming to seek help and assistance and sign up with FEMA and things like that. It offered a space for creative expression and helping to mitigate the mental and emotional toll of the disaster through just fostering self-connection and shared understanding, and also through the community support that people found in like getting their immediate needs met and met, and then a few steps away having a chance to answer some questions and share their story and connect with others. And this can sound perhaps like a nice to have or sort of fluffy, but the truth is that people, as I mentioned, are making these really serious life-changing decisions in the aftermath of a disaster, and they need those tools to feel connected and grounded. And also to, it's a time when so many of us are running completely on E and in overdrive. And to have a place where people can come and sit and tell a story, or tell their story through collage, or connect with someone else and tell the story, and just sit and in a moment of comfort, is necessary for refilling their energy and their ability to keep going, and just for a moment out of overdrive, so they can sort of like fill themselves back up before they go back to mucking out a basement or things like that. And so it was an extremely simple intervention. It was, just a table and chairs and different supplies for storytelling and some lists of questions and things and guiding questions. And yeah, so it was a very simple but very impactful intervention.
Again, that's so interesting. If you think back on the research of psychologically how we humans orient ourselves in the world, the three to core dimensions are space, time, and relationships. And so often in disasters, space is turned on its head if you've been flooded or burnt out or whatever the disruption has been. Time seems to be all out of kilter. Your normal routine is disrupted. You may be things some things seem to be going really fast, some things seem to be going really slow. So they're both very disorienting. And I think what as I listened to your story about the storytelling intervention you did, it was you're giving people a chance to reorient themselves through relationships, their own into their experience, and then begin to make sense of the space and time elements. So you actually put them in a much healthier psychological space for making the kinds of major decisions you're talking about. We don't want them to be what we call in the emotional basement, where they're doing it from a fear-based state, but actually bringing them back into a place where they feel like they've got some agency and some control, and again, feel some comfort in what's happening around them.
Right, that's exactly right, and those connections that you're talking about, they foster resilience. And as you've mentioned, and as we all are acutely aware of, we live in a world with increasing unpredictable and compounding crises, and resilience is what will keep us safe. But we really can't get to that place of connection and coming together if we don't have access to and also permission to metabolize the events that have happened and integrate them into our personal narrative, and then find others to weave those collective stories with, and then move from that place. And so it is that resilience building of the we've got ourselves and we've got each other in the aftermath that I think really allows communities to emerge with a sense of identity and a sense of togetherness and a sense of possibility of that the response to the crisis doesn't have to be just a return to normal, but to a return to like what is possible thereafter and how we want to rebuild with a sense of possibility.
And speaking of resilience, you also work with some communities in Greece that have been displaced by conflict. What role did storytelling play there, and what was that work like?
Yeah, so something that I know that we have all seen with displaced communities is a complete like co-opting of their narratives by the media or by the countries that they land in post-displacement, and often their stories are told for them. And so I find it really urgent to have opportunities for people to tell their own stories of where they've been, what they've seen, and why they are where they are. And so certainly storytelling interventions and the ones I designed in that during that time are only one of the many types of support that people in a crisis need. But the faster we have tools and support for people to see themselves as the storytellers and as the experts in their own lives and needs, the faster we can respond to those needs based on those, like that self-concept, rather than through a lens of like frenzied and often biased media of what we think these people might need. And so I think there's something really crucial. You know, it should be a basic human right to be able to tell your own story through your own lens, but that is so often taken from people who've been displaced. And so putting that back in their hands as the storytellers, it allows a moment of returning to that self-concept and that agency in telling stories. And as we know, when people feel as though they have agency, they can make decisions that are, you know, for the betterment of themselves and their families amidst like incredibly just harrowing circumstances. That I think the very least we can do is give people tools to express their agency through.
Now, this can all sound a bit abstract. I mean, you mentioned your intervention in Vermont was fairly simple with just a table and chairs and some basic tools. But share a bit about how you go about the process. So let's say, for example, you were called down to New Orleans after that horrific attack on New Year's Eve. What would you do? What would it look and feel like so that our listeners can get an idea of what they may be able to do if they want to incorporate this into their thinking and planning?
Yeah, certainly. So the first thing I do is find out the places and spaces where impacted communities are gathering or being gathered, depending on the nature of the crisis. It depends if people are, you know, going to their usual gathering spaces or being gathered in other spaces for their safety, or that's where resources is and things like that. So identifying those places. And then the second thing I'd make sure is that people had really comforting food and nourishment, as they define it. So, you know, figuring out how to have just really good nourishment available. And given that, you know, in the aftermath of an attack, that we want to move quickly to make sure that people have the resources they need, I would bring really large pieces of paper and some writing utensils and have really largely written guiding questions on the paper and invite people to tell their story through answering these questions, really open-ended questions, or through a conversation with a loved one. I would have the option for people to record their stories if they wanted to have their story preserved. I would have options there for them to collage or any other materials that were readily available. I really find that the key to storytelling, especially in the wake of a crisis, is great questions and just having various supplies available for people to decide how they want to tell that story. And questions really help people feel understood and access parts of their story they might not otherwise know how to digest. And so I think the questions we ask are really important to sort of show and exemplify that we understand, certainly not what they are experiencing, but what somebody in their shoes might be experiencing. And it can be sort of when in the aftermath of a violent attack, there's so many narratives running and so much going on, and so much of it can be extremely disorienting and dissociative. And so when you ask somebody a really grounding, caring question with an intent to listen, and allow them to tell their story from there, it gives them sort of an anchor in that moment to hold on to sort of move forward from. And so I would really start with that approach, as well as for folks who are not feeling like they want to say their story out loud, again, having the materials available for them to choose a different way to digest that experience. And then I would offer the people who participated the opportunity to take their creation or recorded or written story or however they decided to express themselves home with them. And I would also offer to keep it for them and use it to create something for the community, that everyone had to have access to in the years to come as they continue to process this moment. That can be a really important moment, is not only having this fairly immediate opportunity for people to metabolize through story and move through this experience with through story and connection through story, but also to make something to honor those stories that they can use as a tool, as inevitably, you know, as we know in crises, it's so common that around the, say, 1 year later, that sort of date peg can become really activating and other things. But to have something that folks and the community can go to that is public to look back on to say, wow, like, look what we created in the aftermath of this, and look where we are now. And just again, those anchoring tools. And then after the initial shock, maybe a few months later and in continuation, I would offer what I call story gatherings for people to come together and share their stories. So these again are really simple. It's a matter of having a room with chairs and good food. And at these events, I would offer people opportunities again to have their stories recorded. I'm a big fan of audio-only recording. I think that the presence of a camera, even though we are all very used to having cameras out in public spaces, the presence of a camera can change the nature of storytelling, whereas like audio of having a microphone and just really simple recording devices available in some way, if they wanted to be able to again use those stories as advocacy tools. So it's really the stories after the initial shock, after the metabolization of that a few months later, and a year later, and however long it's possible to keep story gatherings going, those stories can really be used as advocacy tools because it's showing like the shock has passed, but still the rebuilding is happening. And what do the folks experiencing that rebuilding and doing that rebuilding need? And as we talked about at the top of our recording, that stories are really powerful advocacy tools because we are hardwired to listen to them. So when decision makers hear stories of the folks that they are responsible for serving, they have an opportunity to make really empathetic decisions aligned with what individuals are expressing that they need at that time.
So I want to pull in a couple of threads out of what you just shared, and thank you. That was really useful. One was you mentioned more than once food, and I think that's such an important thing because we do tell stories through food. Food is part of our family history, our ethnic heritage, our community. There are things around food that I think, again, can open the door to people telling stories about, I remember this, or my grandmother made that, or and it's one of the ways we tend to come together and help each other. From that story I told earlier about the restaurants in LA right now, I was thinking back to Rebecca Solnit's wonderful book, A Paradise Built in Hell, that looked at disasters from San Francisco earthquake in the early part of the 20th century up through Katrina, and how communities come together. One of the things they always come together to do is feed each other and take care of each other, which again, I think creates a great space for potential space for storytelling. The second thing I think is that you talked about, in some ways, you're asking, you're not, we often come in as experts and say, let me tell you what's going to happen, or we're going to tell you what you need to do right now. And I think what you're talking about, these stories, is stopping to ask what wants to happen. And by listening to the community members, you can get a sense of what actually wants to happen here, and then figure out how you integrate your resources and all the other great things, the expertise and that your larger entity maybe representing can bring to the table, but fit it into what wants to happen as opposed to trying to impose something on them. And in the last bit, you talked about questions quite a bit. Can you give us an example of one or two of the prompting questions you use in these exercises?
One question that really opens up a lot is what would bring you comfort right now? And that question helps people to see who are the really important people to them that they want to bring into the aftermath as they process this experience, you know, because a lot of times when we think about comfort, we think about the relationships that bring us comfort. And also, as I mentioned before, you know, when people are running in on overdrive and E, and, you know, the gas tanks are on E, and the thing that comes to mind might be, you know, I think about in the aftermath of the Vermont flooding, people swimming in rivers, like finding good swimming holes in Vermont is like it is like the most sacred summer activity. Like it is the thing. And so when we give people, and so many people said, you know, I want to take a dip in the river, but of course you can't take a dip in the river when the river is raging and all of the waterways have just flooded. And so, but it's reminding them of those simple things that sort of tether them to the moment and that they can find comfort in. And when they tell stories from that place, they are reminded of, you know, that what is important to them, what grounds them, and also what will be important going forward and what they want to protect. We want to protect the things that keep us feeling comfortable. And I think another really in question is is what do we need to know? And that can just, and that opens up people. At no point do we want to ask people, what happened to you, things like that, because that, everyone, no one owes us an answer to a question like that. That is their experience. But if we say, what do we need to know? Someone who really needs to tell the story of what they experienced might tell you that, or someone might tell you, what they need in the aftermath and things like that. So it's a really open question that doesn't create an expectation that any specific story will be told. We don't want to create an expectation that we never want to say, tell me about the worst thing that's ever happened to you, which is basically, what we're asking people in the wake of a disaster for saying what happened, things like that. But what do we need to know? Because the we there is undefined, which can also be helpful. They might look around and see the other people there who are also in this aftermath with them and think, we need to know that we will be okay and we will build back. Or they might think, oh, I need decision makers to know. So it keeps the we really broad, and it just keeps the question really broad, and people can come at it from many different angles depending on what they want to share.
I love that. Thank you. I think that's really helpful because I think it's so easy to go to the so yeah. So what happened, which makes them relive the trauma, or what do you need? And they may not quite know what they need or how to express it. But what do we need to know is really good. And what would bring you comfort? Again, putting people in a better space from which to begin that recovery journey. So you mentioned in Vermont, you sort of showed up and set up a table next to a recovery center. How can officials and other leaders better appreciate and engage with storytelling for community recovery? So it's not a, hey, Madison happens to be in the neighborhood and does this, but we actually bake it into what we're going to do. And I'm also thinking as we talk that this is at one level, it's about the community that's affected, but then at another level, it's going to also be around the first responders and all the other those who come to deliver assistance because they're going to have their own level of trauma potentially and their own running, in overdrive with the tank on empty, or I guess now we should say the EV charger on empty. But they're going to have to go through this process as well. So how can officials and other leaders engage with this? And because my sense is that this is more the exception than the rule that we're putting storytelling into the process.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it is, at least in my experience. And yeah, and we could have a whole nother many hour conversation about how leaders of teams of first responders can use story for the people who are responding as well, and how important that is, for what they have seen and what they have experienced. And there's some great interventions that have been tried and shown to be incredibly effective. But that's a whole nother conversation. But I think, appreciation and engagement stem from understanding. And so when leaders, I think there's really a misunderstanding of the importance of storytelling interventions in the direct aftermath of a crisis. So when leaders understand how storytelling helps communities process trauma and foster that connection and build that resilience, they're more likely to prioritize it and more likely to understand that individual and collective healing aspect to it. And so I think there's first, yeah, that appreciation of that understanding of what potential it has when storytelling is made a process of built into the process of disaster recovery. And then, additionally, I'm not sure that leaders fully appreciate how storytelling can act as a strategic tool. When held with care, these processes of storytelling can really inform recovery planning, identify those unmet needs, and build trust between leaders and communities. And so that's where it's really, you realize, like, oh, it's not the nice to have. It's crucial if we want to truly recover as communities and build that resilience. And that finally, I think especially in crisis response, and I work across the healthcare system, and it feels like there's constantly something to respond to and quickly. Adding a new process can feel extremely daunting and is often really daunting, especially with the constraints that organizations are feeling currently. But it doesn't have to be daunting. Storytelling can really be incorporated into existing processes. It can be embedded into needs assessments and community planning sessions and evaluations to ensure that the voices of affected individuals are heard. And so it doesn't have to be this, like, oh wow, like in amidst everything that we're trying to figure out logistically, there has to be this whole new process that we build. It's how can you build something so important and so crucial into the processes that you already have? I think on an individual level, it's like, I think of it almost as like habit stacking, but how can you do like organizational habit stacking of that? And then Also, ahead of a crisis, before it happens in planning, think about the places where you can build storytelling into the preparedness plans, responses, and recovery frameworks, remembering that communities that are already connected through story are more resilient, and we can lay that foundation ahead of time, and build that community resilience so that people are showing up for each other and cooking meals for each other and having these really crucial moments of telling stories.
Leaders, take note, write down every word that she just said and go do it, please. Then my final question for you, it's the same one I ask each one of my guests. What gives you hope?
So, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, I'm Indigenous, and a lot of Indigenous folks, myself included, are born in what we see as like between seven generations, and so we are responsible for the generations before us that came before us that brought us to life, and also the generations to come. And I find so much hope in that when I think of like the experiences of my ancestors and what they endured in order to bring me to where I am, and then similarly the huge responsibility I have for the generations to come. And another role that I play is I'm also a doula, and so I very have a hands-on role with the next generations. And when I see these babies come to the world, it gives me so much hope that we are taking responsibility for the world that we hand to them, and also that the world that was handed to us. And so that responsibility on both end gives me a lot of hope, because it stops any despair, because there's no time for it when you have so much responsibility.
Well, there you go. There can be nothing more hopeful than bringing that next generation into the world. So thank you for sharing that. My guest for this episode has been Madison Murphy Barney. You can find more about her work at madisonmurphybarney.com. And until next time, be ready for the You're It moment when you're called to lead. And don't forget to check out our AI and Leadership Workshop coming up on March 18th and 19th in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can find details at npli.hsph.harvard.edu. Till then, be safe, be well, be ready to lead. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter at @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening, and be ready to lead.